Paperman meets such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people.
Here we are with the Media Project. It's an opportunity for a little bit of commentary and analysis on the news media issues of the week, and sometimes we even bring some insight to it. That's our goal, commentary, analysis, and insight. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Doctor.
I read in the paper that coffee is not bad for you.
Well, that's good. Let me have another swallow then, and I'll be ready for this conversation. Judy Patrick is here, vice president of the New York Press Association, longtime editor of the Daily Gazette, she was.
Let's do this.
And Kaylin Brown, head of journalism and communications at College of St. Rose. What's going on?
News galore that we have to get to.
Right. Let's do that. Just a little word. The president takes to Twitter, as we all know, and I just have to read this little exchange because it's just too fun. The president last Sunday in the evening tweeted, "The failing NY Times story on Mexico and illegal immigration through our southern border has now been proven shockingly false and untrue. Bad reporting, and the paper is embarrassed by it. The only problem is that they knew it was fake news, capital F, capital N, before it went out. Corrupt media, exclamation point." The Twitter response from the New York Times Communications Department is, "Actually, we stand by our story. We are confident in our reporting. And as with so many other occasions, our stories stand up over time, and the president's denials of them do not. Calling the press the enemy is undemocratic and dangerous." Which raises the question, does this kind of a response from the New York Times fuel further the notion that the press is not to be trusted by the president and his supporters? Are we, in other words, by defending ourselves, are we making ourselves more the target for the president? Or should we, is this defense appropriate?
Well, this is the big question with Trump. Do you fight back? A lot of people think that the potential presidential primaries that are going to be coming up on the Democratic side, and then the debates with the president when they come, you have to answer him. He's a bully. He has to be answered. You know, Mario Cuomo used to say to us, Rex, if you remember, every negative comment has to be answered. He would say that again and again. Otherwise, somebody's going to think it's true. But it is a dilemma for an awful lot of people, including the media. The response from the Times that you just read was clearly just boring. It's a boring response as opposed to, you know, hit him in the kishkas response. And that in itself tells you that he has the advantage.
You know, it's interesting that it came from the communications department at the paper and not the editor. And the editor has at times spoken up about it. I mean, when I edited a paper, it was a debate inside my head about whether or not to respond or to stand up for the paper and just assert the facts in a boring way.
In a boring way, yeah.
It's appropriate that the New York Times responded the way it did. It had no choice but to respond, especially on behalf of its readers and the people it intends to be readers. You have to stand up for whatever your journalism is. So it was attacked by the highest office in the country, the journalism was, so the Times had no choice but to respond. I don't think it was boring. I think it spoke to the newspaper's integrity.
Well, yes. And one of the things is that when we say Dean Baquet did not answer the editor, the communications department did it, I can only imagine there must have been a lot of back and forth going on about, because the communications department doesn't go out there and do it on its own without some direction.
Nor would the Times tweet something cavalierly.
It is a bit more of a subtle question, but fundamentally deriving from the same notion, this question of whether reporters should be restricted from appearing on what are perceived to be programs with a bias. This issue comes up because Dean Baquet, as you mentioned, the executive editor of the New York Times, has said now that he is concerned about reporters appearing on clearly opinionated shows, that he wants his reporters to steer clear of that. And now there is some effort by MSNBC to try to reel this back in, to say this, in effect, cold shoulder that we're getting from the New York Times is something that we regret. We want Times reporters to be able to appear on MSNBC. And sometimes reporters, it should be pointed out, some Washington Post reporters, a number of print reporters are in fact paid for appearances on cable channels.
That's interesting.
Where they sit on panels where there are people that are quite opinionated. So how far do you go when you're a reporter who has a beat and you actually have to cover people on all sides? You do take a risk when you go onto a show where there are opinionated hosts and folks with opinions.
No question about it. I watch Maggie Haberman. Now, she goes on CNN, which is the most milquetoast of the group of cable stations, but she's very, very careful about how she conducts herself. You wish she'd come out swinging, and she's had some very important stories, which have been very embarrassing to the President of the United States. But when she's on that program, you would not think that she's some wild-eyed, crazy person. She's very, very reticent to be terribly critical.
Yeah, but she's often sitting next to a wild-eyed, crazy person. And I think just by associations, her reputation as an unbiased reporter gets tainted. I hate it when I see reporters on these types of panels because I think it erodes the integrity of our profession.
But she has no choice because the Times, and see, this is where it gets interesting, Rexy. The Times, obviously, has made a decision that they want their people on these shows. Because the more they're on, the better it is for the newspaper.
It's free publicity. It's true.
Yeah.
Not only is it free publicity, though, the value of having a Times reporter who leaves the newsroom and goes to share his or her information and knowledge somewhere else is that it exposes more audience members to the content of the Times. And it humanizes the Times. I see some value in it, but I do agree that it needs to be very carefully conducted interviews and the comportment that we talk about with Maggie Haberman. I mean, she's an extraordinary journalist.
That's a great word. I want you to know that, Kaylin.
Comportment.
Comportment. Oh. Mm-hmm. Comportment.
I know I said it.
Comportment is something.
She's a PhD, you know.
Well, it's a wonderful word which takes us back in history to the way in which people were expected to behave themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Hey, let's not forget the fact that the cable stations are taking advantage of these reporters. If they have a reporter come out and do the work, then they actually don't have to do the reporting themselves.
Exactly, because they don't. They don't do that kind of deep reporting. That is not what these cable channels are set up to do.
And well, now CNN does a pretty good job, Rex, don't you think?
By comparison to, of course, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the great newspapers. They do reporting, yes.
Not original reporting in many cases.
Sometimes they do. They do a lot of original reporting.
Yes, yeah. That's
true. They got that little guy, goes around, he puts a microphone in front of everybody's face.
Well, let's hear it. Let's hear it putting a microphone in front of people's faces.
That's reporting.
And they bring news.
The fascinating reporting doesn't happen on camera. It happens in dark corners, and it happens with piles of paper and documents or on the interwebs where you're so deep in there you can't get out. I mean, digging deep in reporting has nothing to do with talent, which is a term used in the broadcast industry sometimes. It's not that kind of talent. We're not talking about becoming famous.
Professor, I just want you to know how deeply I disagree with you.
Oh, no.
I mean, that sounds like journalism, what you would tell your kids in journalism, 101. The real reporting goes on in the dark.
Happens to be true.
Well, no, it doesn't happen to be true.
Educate us, man.
Yeah, we're all waiting to hear.
Give it a try.
I don't like the way you drop that term, man. What if I were to say to you, woman?
I just said
we'd say, too late, it's our turn, and you need to chill out.
Take it back. Okay, so what happens is CNN does a wonderful job of reporting. They go around, and they break stories all the time, and it's not done in some web-encrusted part of the library. And therefore, I think that, you know, you're continual, the three of you.
We continue to be right on this topic.
No, you continue to shill for the newspapers, the dying newspapers.
Dying newspapers! And this is a bad thing that, it's our fault. It's because
you,
we...
By the way, Rex.
There's no shilling. We're talking about the truth
here. We're talking about journalism and reporting, and I'm sorry you don't have respect for it.
I have a lot of respect for newspapers.
Well, sometimes it takes a lot of digging, and it takes a lot of work, what's being described here.
Which is sometimes.
Hey, you know, when the newspapers die, what will the television stations read? I mean, what will the basis of the reporting be?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hear you.
They'll be lost. CNN does a lot of reporting about natural disasters, press conferences, but you know, not to beat up on CNN, but and they do a good job of what they do, but real reporting, that's
what they do. Now, that's not all. It's not just television. Listen to this statistic, $4.7 billion. That is the amount of money that Google made last year from the work of news publishers via search and Google News. In other words, all of this work that the independent media do, newsrooms like those that we all worked in, gets absorbed and fed out to the world via Google News. So that's a good thing. Google then attaches advertising to that and gets $4.7 billion a year, not a penny of which is shared with those who created that content.
So I get that. And you've been bitching about aggregators and other things for a long time now, Rex, not without reasons. However, what would you like to see? Would you like to see Google start to write checks to the news media?
Well, yes, that. But beyond that, there are some questions. For example, here's the kind of thing that might help in this situation. If there were antitrust exemptions created by Congress for the news media so that newspapers could collaborate to create their own sites that could then share revenue in the way that Google does not. It doesn't seem to me that our communities are being served when the newsrooms that focus on local news are unable to compete with these behemoths like Google and Facebook.
Well, what do you think the possibilities are that that will happen, Rex? I mean, with all due respect, you know, you work for the Hearsts and they make money on your newspaper, don't they?
Yes. Yeah, they do, but not nearly as much as they used to.
Well, I'm so sorry about that, but they do make money. And then,
they actually own the buildings. I mean, if you're against capitalism, then that's fine.
Did I say I was against capitalism?
Well, I don't know. You seem to be making it. Is it a dirty word to make money? I don't know. I mean, you can say that maybe newspapers should all be not for profit, but there are downsides to that as well. But the fundamental of capitalism is the owner who takes the risk has the opportunity for profit, right?
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm glad that they are making money, and I'm glad you're making money, and I'm glad that Mr. Hearst is making money. But in the end, why should we start giving exemptions from monopoly to newspapers?
Well, why should you have an exemption here at WAMC from paying taxes? You're a not-for-profit organization, and you're tax-exempt, so should we take that away? No, I don't think so.
Rexy, you're not up to this.
Here we go.
Let me just tell you, what we're talking about here is not-for-profit. As opposed, I don't own this station. There is not ownership here.
Right.
So therefore, it's in the public interest, and this is granted to us. But in the case of, as you just said, a capitalistic institution, they got to take the heat because the owners get the money.
Yeah, my point, I understand, but it's a fine line. That is, I'm just saying that we make rules in tax laws to subsidize that which we value and to tax where there is excessive value. That's what tax laws do. They redistribute wealth. So tax laws are designed to encourage this kind of not-for-profit work the WAMC does. That's terrific. And I just think that if we as a society value local journalism, then we have to consider what ways we can make our laws work so that they will encourage local journalism instead of allowing these massive companies, Google and Facebook,
and
to just absorb everything.
And you don't like the aggregators either, right?
They're mostly small.
But it doesn't matter. Small, the principle is the same, isn't it? That they take your work, they put it up. Sometimes they even add ads to what they're doing, and you don't like that. And I don't blame you for not liking it.
Yeah, we get a little bit of a benefit from it because the traffic comes back to us.
Right,
you know, they post our stuff, and so that's fine. But it's the big guys, you know, of the digital ad dollars. 2/3 of all the digital ad spend in the world goes to Google, Facebook, Yahoo, and fill in another one for me. Basically, all of the digital ad dollars are going away.
They're picky about it, and if they'd be less picky about it, the newspapers or the media companies would be better off. I mean, I think they could share a little more.
Okay, then now see, we already heard Rex do a tremendous defense earlier. I was very impressed with it, of capitalism versus, you know, non-capitalism. And I was very respectful of that. I didn't realize he was that concerned about the state of American capitalism, but he did make a cogent argument for capitalism. But now he's making an argument for sharing. That's called socialism.
No. Sharing is called what we learned in kindergarten. It's good. It's a good thing. By the way, there is this effort launched by the New York State Bar Association to look at some of these legal changes chaired by David McCraw, the Deputy General Counsel for the New York Times. And I'm a member of this task force. I'm actually one of the three non-lawyer members who is part of this task force. It's going to hold hearings around the state to...
When do you work? When do you edit your paper? You're always on a thing, a press. You're in the White House. You're
sitting here in front of a microphone, helping provide free programming for this not-for-profit organization.
Absolutely.
Here.
Exactly,
it's a good thing.
And we hope that student journalists and the idea of education and journalism would be included in that task force efforts, because I think it matters what's happening in academia to train future journalists, and that the Bar Association's task force could benefit from talking to educators.
So let me get this straight. You're going to go around with this task force, and what is the objective of the task force?
To find out if there are changes in the law or changes that lawyers themselves ought to endorse or be a part of that could help support local journalism. The concern is that local journalism is imperiled. And so the Bar Association, under its new president, an Albany lawyer named Hank Greenberg, is going to do this task force for hearings around the state, because journalism is a foundational element of American democracy.
Well, I agree with that. However, let me ask you, isn't there a potential here that lawmakers and others who are so dependent on the press will fold over in order to, will genuflect, will give you everything that you want because they're afraid you would be mad at them?
We should be so lucky.
Oh, we should. There are so many bills before the legislature that are anti-journalism that we would love to see pass that there's strong resistance to, including...
Well, give us an example.
The ability to access the
disciplinary files of police officers. There you go. Section 50A of the New York State Civil Rights Law. The cops, firefighters, corrections officers, all of their disciplinary material is locked away. We are not allowed to see it.
And they are a powerful lobby group, right?
Right. They are indeed. Yeah. Much
apparently
more powerful,
than journalism.
I don't know that it's more, but it is offsetting, isn't it?
Well,
it would be interesting if the work in Congress concerning antitrust and Google and Facebook were to break up those industries and somehow also, in doing so, return some value back to journalism in terms of either money, audience, not-for-profit. That's happening. One for-profit newspaper in this country is going not-for-profit. So, you know, there are other ways to fix this. I absolutely think that we need to think outside the box. I know that is a cliche, but there are other ways to make this journalism model work.
Well, let me just say, my heart bleeds blue borscht for all of you.
Blue borscht?
Yeah, blue borscht.
I didn't know there was such a thing.
Well,
really?
That's right.
There
only
isn't.
In the borscht belt.
Yeah.
I guess it's the royal borscht. That's the Chartreuse or royalty.
Well, it is
right?
Interesting, though, if you think about what we were just talking about. you know, the various unions put a lot of money into the legislature, right? Rex and his group and you guys can't do that. You can't give lots of money to influence the way in which the legislature passes laws, because it wouldn't look right. So you're at a disadvantage.
And we don't have the money because we're struggling to keep going. You know, if we had extra money, we wouldn't be buying legislators. We'd be hiring reporters. So we are at a disadvantage, whereas Alphabet, which is Google's parent, and Facebook, you know, they are big distributors for news publishers. That's definitely true. For external traffic that comes to news sites, that is about 80% of it comes through Google and Facebook. So, you know, to that extent, we do get business, we get revenue, we get eyeballs because of those big aggregators. It's just that the dollar value of that does not come close to matching what has been lost in this digital revolution. I think we just need to look at ways to deal with the digital revolution that has come upon us, because we are at risk of losing this, as I said, foundational element of American democracy and civic life, which is local journalism.
What if the New York Times or the Washington Post or some of the newspapers that are truly succeeding in the digital environment now were to create some sort of connection with local newspapers? I know this sounds completely opposite of what the industry and capitalism would ask for, but could the Times share the wealth somehow. I know it seems naive, Alan, but it's not meant to be naive because the Times benefits, too, from good local journalism.
Well, first of all, papers like my local paper, the Berkshire Eagle, do subscribe to the New York Times and you do too, right, Rex? So you guys will print.
We do use the New York Times content.
What the professor is talking about here is the idea that somehow they would share their profits.
No. I'm talking about spinning off new models. What if there were some sort of a collaboration between various newspapers in downtown somewhere, in downtown anywhere in the United States, and there was some sort of a skeletal framework that the Times and other newspapers helped to feed and nurture to encourage a different way of thinking about local journalism? I think local journalism is struggling so much to just get done what it's supposed to be doing, delivering information to readers and viewers. I don't know what the answer is, but I think the Times could help local journalism or other big players could help.
If there were not the antitrust laws. Well, they can help, but you mean share their profits somehow?
No, I'm thinking more in the terms of creating new kinds of models where you have, for instance, I would like to see interns in the LCA. I would like
the Legislative Correspondents Association
in the state capitol, thank you, Rex, would have student journalists for every single newspaper down there and might be creating some sort of content that would be new or different or would speak to that population, that generation more.
And there's a great example because that would require a change in federal labor laws because right now the model of labor law, at least the way it's interpreted in this state, does not allow for internships unless they are paid, fully paid.
Yes, so, and of course, only one person in this room ever started a newspaper that caters exclusively to young people to cover the legislature. That's me.
And that was an excellent idea, and that should be
absolutely
reconfigured.
But look at how this is an example, actually. The Legislative Gazette was a thriving print enterprise, but it has disappeared as a print enterprise. Does it still exist digitally?
Oh, yes, very much so.
And that's the difficulty. Because it's subsidized by the state university, it can afford to do this work still.
No, but actually, it has to support itself. It's really not subsidized. However, it isn't what it once was, but it's still there, and it is online.
But see, this is what we're saying, that the same thing is true of, you know, the newspaper I used to be the editor of in the 90s, The Record in Troy.
Yeah, where my column appears weekly.
It's they are hard up for content these days. That's my point. We had a newsroom of about 39 people when I went there, and now I think there are 5. And so you can see what kind of, you know, we try to cover Troy from the Times Union, the regional approach, but we can't cover it as thoroughly as my newsroom in Troy used to cover it back in the 90s.
I need to mention that out of the 5 that work in the Troy Record newsroom, 4 came through St. Rose journalism classes.
All right. Excellent.
But I also wanted to make the point about local newspapers is the fact that the hyper-local quality of the real local newspapers is something that doesn't take advantage of a Google worldwide distribution, that they don't care if someone in if a story goes viral because that's not who their audience is, and their content is probably never going to go viral. So that seems to be overlooked in this discussion. Everybody wants to get the big viral story that gets a million clicks. So they get, what, $10 in Google ad revenue. And so the focus of the Bar Association, I think, also should be on the hyper-local quality of the more than 700 newspapers still in New York State.
Yes.
Well, one last thing, and that is I've been talking about this for several weeks now, but as you know, in my little town of Great Barrington, one lady who goes to every single meeting of government puts out a very good magazinelet.
A magazinelet?
Yeah, it comes to you for $35. Eileen Mooney is the woman's name. And so the only reason I mention it is because nature does abhor a vacuum. And she covers town government in the way that newspapers used to cover it. And every single thing that happens is named, and she talks about it. So maybe that's the look of the future. Maybe that vacuum will be filled in by other entrepreneurs.
That could be. We may hope. If you have thoughts on this, by the way, we have failed to let you know in this show so far that you can talk to us. media@wamc.org is how you can reach us and share your thoughts. Alan Shartok, Judy Patrick, Caitlin Brown, and Rex Smith here. That media at WAMC.org, by the way, is how we got this story about CNN and the New York Times being in controversy. It's good. Thank you, Ken, our listener in wherever Ken was, for sending it from Catskill.
Okay,
you guys are so lucky. Yes. So lucky to have me on this program, because otherwise it could be called the boring show. The three of you would put, the three of you would put your arms around everybody, around each other, and say, yes, 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 everything in the newspaper is good. We don't have to discuss any of the downside here.
Oh, sorry, I'm just humming Kumbaya. That's a really good thing here. Okay, we just turn to another little topic briefly here. Sinclair Broadcasting, which is trying to build a nationwide network of right-wing TV stations represented in New York's Capital Region by CBS6. They are the station that requires must-carry analysis from guys who run Mr. Trump's staff. They fired a local weatherman who objected to being told at his Illinois station that he had to use the logo Code Red, Weather Alert. He said the alerts are, I guess, sensational. And it is just indicative of the way, I'm afraid, that local broadcast news is going. A, sensational. B, being controlled by a corporate parent.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right, Rex. If you think of Wolf Blitzer, who I very much admire on CNN, he's always saying, stay tuned for more breaking news. Well, breaking news is something you heard, you know, 6 hours ago. But more breaking news, that's the same kind of thing.
The Code Red on the weather is a little more sensational, I think. But what was interesting about this meteorologist is he criticized Sinclair on air. He did it on air. He was making his announcement and letting the world know that he didn't think the broadcaster was adhering to the standards of journalism.
So that's interesting, Rex. So suppose, just suppose, one of your columnists decided to criticize an editorial position or something else of your newspaper. Would he be fired, or she?
I would presume an editor would probably handle the column before it would get to publication. That may be one of the differences here. Probably this guy was on live, and his producers didn't know that he was going to say this. It's
in
a good
words,
question.
The tolerance for an alternative opinion within the same paper might not be handled well.
Well, alternative opinion is different. We have alternative opinions. Our columnist, Chris Churchill, who appears in between opinionated people on your airwaves, back to our earlier topic, Chris will sometimes have a position that is different from our own editorial board.
But he will not specifically criticize the newspaper?
I don't know. I'm trying to think about that. That's a good question.
You know, this is the difference between newsprint and broadcast journalism, because a lot of times it's marketing. It's not really journalism, although I wouldn't say that requiring a red flag.
Code red.
Is a little bit of editorial interference. Maybe it is marketing. I mean, when you watch television news, you see the amount of marketing that takes place, especially with the weather.
Yep, there you go. All right, so we're out of time. Imagine that. Yep. So you have to come back next week to hear more of this conversation. Alan Shartok, Judy Patrick, Kalen Brown, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally...